So the title of my talk is A Point of Freedom, both the title and the theme of my talk, Point of Freedom. And I'll explain what I mean by that as I go along. So I wanted to start by pointing out that there are two essentially different tendencies in the mind. There's a tendency towards reactivity and a tendency that's more creative, spontaneous, open. So this is something that Bhante's drawn out in his, particularly in his pamphlets, Mind Reactive, Mind Creative. But he's very much drawing on something that's a very traditional Buddhist teaching. It's right there in the Pali Canon, perhaps most pithily described in one of the middle-length sayings by attributed to Dharmadina, who's one of the female followers of the Buddha. And she's really drawing out the way that conditionality has two quite distinct modes to it. It's got a what you might call a cyclic mode. So those of you who have been following Bhadra's series on the Wheel of Life will have been hearing about the cyclic nidanas. But it's also got a what Dhammadhyana called a progressive mode. And sometimes that's described in terms of a spiral path. But here I'm going to sort of use the word creative. So there's a tendency towards reactivity, which is characterized by a sort of stuck cyclicness going around the same old habit patterns. But there's also the possibility of a creative response to whatever the situation is, which is kind of fresh and spontaneous. And although sometimes it's described in terms of a path, a cyclic nidana, really it's a sort of something more creative, more spontaneous. It's not so predictable as a reactive mind is. So my basic point is that finding this point of freedom is finding that that sort of fork in the path, if you like. So we're following a path, and there's a sort of fork where reactivity or reaction becomes more of a choice rather than a compulsion. And there's this alternative, more creative choice that becomes apparent. Even if that's just the choice not to react, but to just sit, if you like, just do nothing, to not react. But the choice only becomes apparent when the possibility of a more creative response becomes apparent. Okay, so it's kind of one of the features of reactive mind that it can seem to sort of just encompass the whole space of possibility, but actually it doesn't. And more we become aware of that, more we become aware of this creative option, then we've got this sense of a choice, and then we've got this point of freedom. So as I say, the reactive mind has this tendency to see the whole space of possibilities in terms of just two options, both of them bad. So in relation to a group, for example, a mind reactive would just see the option of conforming with the group or the option of rebelling. And it might seem that's just the only two choices you've got. But the point is, in actual experience, there's nothing there in experience that compels us to react. So one way of putting that I remember hearing quite early on when I was learning the Metta Bhavana, is that no one can make me angry. I don't have to get angry. Sort of thing. They might be really pushing all my buttons, they might be really in my face, I might not like what's going on, but I don't have to get angry. They can't actually make me do that. So compulsions, it's a habit pattern, but it's not essential. It's not something that's really there in our actual experience. There's nothing there that compels me to respond in any particular way to what's going on. So as we become more aware of that, we're getting more in touch with this sense of a point of freedom. And that sort of means that we're more able to act as an individual and to choose whether or not. So in relation to a group, we can choose whether or not to join a Sangha as a free association of individuals. So the Sangha is often described as a free association of individuals, and that's kind of distinct from a group. So it's not really something to which you can conform, and it's not really something against which you can rebel, because it's just not, it's not really in that mode. So Sangha comes about when three individuals choose to relate in the context of Sangha. And when that's not happening, well, Sangha's not happening. So I want to go on to draw out some, you know, particular areas in which this sort of point of freedom is at play. And the first one I wanted to draw out was around meditation. So I'll be leading a meditation after the tea break that's sort of on this theme. So here are just a few words on the topic. So in meditation, we bring to bear a more subtle self-awareness. And in that context, we can connect with a more embodied sense, not just of where we're at, but also a sense of direction. So in terms of what does the body know, what do we have an embodied awareness of, most apparently there's this sense of where I'm at. Okay, so there's a, something that's held in the body which just is just this kind of knowing of this is where I'm at. But there's more than that. There's also a sense of direction. There's a sense of actually this is the way that kind of works for me. And I suggest that there might perhaps be two senses of directions, actually quite immediate and apparent in experience. And these are these two possibilities, the possibility of a reaction or the possibility of a more creative response. So drawing that out in meditation, I'll start with the example of posture. Because we start the meditation by establishing a posture, and once we've done that, there's the opportunity of relaxing into it. So take balance as an example. Once my body's aligned in balance, I no longer need to hold the muscles to keep myself upright. So when I'm balanced, I don't need to hold myself upright. I just balance. So it's possible to relax all of those muscles and allow the weight to just be supported. So that's a sort of relaxing into this aspect of posture, the sort of balance aspect of posture. Now, obviously, it's also possible to relax out of posture, which is just kind of dropping out. So that's a sort of, it's a good initial example because it's generally very clear that there's a possibility of just dropping a whole practice, dropping out of posture, dropping out of meditation. That one's usually fairly obvious. It takes a bit more kind of subtle sort of self-awareness and awareness of your body to kind of recognize that actually within a supportive meditation posture, it's possible to relax into it. So these are these sort of two directions that we can take, which are at this level quite physical directions that the body can take. And then this becomes a sort of quite a sort of general aspect of meditation practice, which is repeated again at different levels. So I'll just draw out the next two levels, and I'm drawing on aspects of the Anapanasati practice. So Anapanasati is the Pali for mindfulness of breathing. And the Anapanasati meditation practice is that form of the mindfulness of breathing which the Buddha taught in the suttas. Okay, so the next sort of stage of meditation where this sort of twofold aspect of establishing and relaxing into is apparent is where we center our attention upon a particular experience. So in this context, a particular experience of the body breathing, we're choosing to center our attention on this physical experience. And that's an establishment. It's an establishing of attention on its object. And once we've done that, once that's established, it's possible to relax into that attention. So we're like establishing our awareness or our attention on its object, and then it's possible to kind of relax into that established attention. And this is one thing that's drawn out explicitly in the Anapanasati, where there's this stage aware of the body I breathe in and out. And then the next stage is relaxing the body. I breathe in, I breathe out. So then, moving on to the third sort of aspect of this practice, where this twofold dynamic of establishing and relaxing into is apparent. So further on in the next group or the next tetrad in the practice, there's a stage where we're establishing our awareness of the mind. Okay. So first there's the physical posture, then there's the way in which our attention is centered upon our physical experience. And then there's the quality of mind, which is the quality of awareness and the quality of attention. So you see we're moving towards more and more subtle objects of attention. Firstly, there's just a sort of straightforward position, posture. Then there's the quality of attention upon a physical experience. And then there's the quality of the mind itself as it attends. And again, we're establishing that in our awareness. Okay, so there's this stage, aware of the mind, I breathe in and out. And then following that, there's this stage, relaxing the mind, I breathe in and out. So again, there's this establishing and then relaxing into. So my suggestion is that in each of these stages, the creative move is the one of relaxing into the practice. And the mind reactive move, if you like, is the one of dropping out of practice. And there's something quite broadly applicable about that in terms of Dharma practice in general. There's a way in which we can establish our practice and then relax into it. And that's subtly different from dropping away from it. And I've often found that the way to a deeper experience in meditation, the way into a more absorbed state of mind in meditation, is through relaxation, through a sort of more of a letting go than a doing, more of a non-doing than a doing. But it does require a getting in touch with that sort of embodied sense of the direction towards relaxing into the practice. And a couple of sort of descriptions around that, just sort of ways of describing how I can recognize that sense of direction. It's a direction towards a more open and expansive presence, as opposed to a sort of tightening into a more applied engagement with meditation where I'm trying to engender the forced result of willed effort. So when I'm kind of losing that sense of my point of freedom in the context of meditation, I can wind up more deliberately practicing in a way that's kind of more willful and that's trying to make something happen, so the forced result of willed effort. And that has a sort of tightening quality to it. And initially it's just going to be a tightening in awareness, a contracting in the space of awareness. And then there'd be a hardening of attention, and then there'd be a more sort of physical tightening of the posture. So you can see that there are those three, again, those three aspects of meditation where we've got this choice to relax into the practice, and at each of those stages, there's also the tendency to drop out or to tighten out of meditation. So on the level of mind, there's a sort of contraction in the space of awareness. On the level of attention, there's a sort of hardening or tightening of attention. On the level of posture, there'll be a sort of muscular grip going on. So at each of those levels, you can kind of spot, oh yeah, this is me moving towards hindrance. It's moving out of meditation. And there is another direction that we can go. So again, in relation to meditation, you can see this is a choice between, on the one hand, relaxing into a more absorbed quality of awareness, into the dhyana factors, into dhyana as a state of attention, or, conversely, tightening up and sort of moving more into this direction of hindrance. So as I say, the path towards a deeper experience of meditation, I found, is often one of finding this point of freedom, where there are these two embodied senses of direction, where these two senses of direction meet at a point of choice. Another way of putting this is that you can only meditate effectively from where you're at. So it's tempting to sort of want to be perhaps more concentrated than I am, want to be in a different state of mind or having a different experience to the one I've got. So I'm trying to be somewhere else. And it's not possible to meditate effectively other than where I'm at. But the counter to that, the counterpoint to that is that it's always possible to find that place where it is possible to meditate effectively. So that's kind of a point of freedom. The point of freedom, in another angle, is where we're at. It's where it's possible to actually make a difference, to apply an effort in a creative and effective sort of way. And more often than not, I find that the choice to make is one of relaxing, one of finding that direction, relaxing into it. It's more of a non-doing, in a way, than a doing. Okay, so that was a particular application of this point of freedom perspective, broadening out somewhat. In terms of practice more broadly, so you can see the point of freedom as that point which is always here and now, where we can choose freedom rather than the bondage of mind reactive. That's the German framework. And more broadly, in terms of Dharma practice, you can see this as a free choice to go for refuge, or particularly to go for refuge to the three jewels, rather than to quote the Dhammapada, sacred hills, woods, groves, trees and shrines, which are not safe refuges, they're not true refuges. And in modern terms, I think that would be conventional religion, social groups, material aspirations. So making that choice, just moment-to-moment choice to go for refuge. I remember one of my friends from when I was, way back when I was a Mitra, saying, it has to be now. If you want to go for refuge effectively, it has to be something you're doing now. You can't go for refuge next week, or it can't be something you've done in the past. If you actually want an effective practice, the only place that that can be is now, really. So you can see this point of freedom as being in touch with the spirit of the practice, whatever form that might take. So whether it's ethics, meditation, puja, dharma study, kalyana mitta, living in community, team-based right livelihood, whatever it is. So it's the ability to be in touch with the spirit of the practice and to get a feel for how we might act in line with that spirit. So to take another particular example of ethical practice, and so I do think this is very, very closely related to meditation practice. I think you can think of ethical practice in terms of the positive forms of all the precepts, and they all align very closely with meditation practice. So metta bhavana is all about deeds of loving kindness. Then mindfulness breathing is all about with mindfulness clear and radiant. Both of those practices are all about stillness, simplicity, contentment. So ethics and meditation are really kind of interleaved very closely. And so in relation to ethical practice, the point of freedom is about having that feel for the experiential tone of a more ethically wholesome or skillful mental state, as opposed to the tone, the experience of something more unwholesome or unskillful intentions in our mind. And when we've got that sense of the experiential difference, the actual, you know, felt, experienced sense difference, the unique experiential signature that is recognisably wholesome or recognisably unwholesome, reactive. When we've got that that sort of familiarity, then we can recognise skillful intentions in our mind, and when we can do that, we can just be really confident about acting from them. Because in Buddhist terms, ethics is an ethics of intention. And what that means is that when you're confident of the quality of your intention, you can be confident of acting from that. You don't have to know the right thing to do. So that's very much as a contrast with having in mind a set of rules and referring to a set of rules and deciding what to do that's in line with a set of rules. And it has more of a feel of freedom to it, because I think if I'm just kind of feeling obliged to follow the set of rules, that doesn't have much of a sense of point of freedom about it. But if I have this sense of, this is the quality of my experience, this is the quality of my intentionality, I can recognise the sort of wholesomeness of these aspects of mine and the sort of reactivity of those, and I can kind of choose to go with the more wholesome. So that, to me, that has much more of a sense of freedom around it. Okay. So moving on to communication as another example. So communication with friends in the Sangha. So there's this lovely phrase within the threefold puja, may our communication with one another be Sangha. And that's very much how I like to relate to Sangha, including Sangha as a refuge. So there's a possibility of real communication, in actual communication, with friends in the Sangha. And that's that real communication is the Sangha refuge. And it's particularly a practice where there's a difference of view. Okay, so if you find that actually my view, my orientation towards practice, my enthusiasm is here, you don't understand that, it's not what you're about, you have a different view, then there's a real practice of communication. And in this context, mind reactive will only see these two bad possibilities of go along with the other person's view or reject it, accept or reject. So either aligning myself with someone else or aligning myself against them. So that's all that mind reactive will see in terms of possibilities. So I'd suggest the point of freedom is where we've got a sense of the possibility of communication that involves finding an understanding of their view and a way of effectively communicating, conveying one's own, in a way that can be understood. So rather than feeling I have to align with theirs or reject against it, I can sort of endeavour to communicate, which is both understanding and expressing, effectively conveying my own practice, my own view. So that involves finding this kind of deeper common ground, that's the common ground of going for refuge. And when we can do that, then there's a great flexibility that arises. You might find that initially, where there's difference, there's a sort of hardening of positions, there's not much sense of flexibility. But when you get to this sort of sense of common ground, that you're both going for refuge in a way that you can kind of recognise and respond to in each other, from that, there comes a sense of sort of mutually being in touch with the spirit of the principles of the practice, rather than kind of holding on to the letter or the form of it. So this is, for me, this is the way towards practicing in harmony with friends and brethren. So harmony is not, to me, just happening to be of the same opinion as somebody else. I think harmony is about being in touch with that common ground and having a first impulse towards communication, towards finding it when there's difference of view. So I just like to particularly rejoice in Joanna Molyneux in this area. I really do think that that's something that she exemplifies. I've noticed that where we've disagreed about something, our first response is, okay, let's get together and talk about that, getting communication around it. Yeah, and I think that's what makes for a sangha rather than a group. So lastly, moving on to the more broader theme of going for refuge. As I say, this harmony is based on a deeper common ground, and the deeper common ground is our shared recognition of going for refuge. Going for refuge is the central and defining act of being a Buddhist. There's one point where I think it was in the early 70s, someone once asked Bante what we could change. So Bante, up until this point, had been pretty much leading everything. And then he decided to take an extended sabbatical. I don't think it was clear at the time how long the extended sabbatical was going to be, but it was quite some time. And he basically left them to it. So people like Dharmadina and Vajradhaka were kind of, oh, okay, we're going to have to run classes, we're going to have to run the centre. If it's going to carry on, it's going to be us that's doing it. And one of them asked Bante, so, well, what can we change? And he replied, you can change everything except going for refuge. Everything except going for refuge. So this is sort of just communicating that, yeah, the real centrality yeah, centrality of going for refuge and the underlying nature of it. So when we've got this common ground, we've got this shared recognition of going for refuge, that the other person's going for refuge in the way that I understand it, that one understands it oneself, and in the way that I'm going for refuge myself. And it's worth pointing out that there are only two main ceremonies in the Chiratna, what do we call it, Chiratna Mandala, Chiratna community, and they're both recognition of going for refuge. So we have the Mitra ceremony where we're recognizing that someone's sincerely going for refuge, that whatever else is going on in their lives, this is something they want to do. And we have the ordination ceremony, which is recognizing that someone's effectively going to refuge, they've been able to make that practice effectively broadly across their life. So they're both a recognition of going for refuge, which you can see as a recognition that someone has found that point of freedom, yeah? That they're able to participate in this free association of individuals that is our Sangha. So they all kind of join up. So practicing Sangha is an aspect of going for refuge. I tend to think of going for refuge in terms of practicing Sangha, finding that quality of communication that has this quality of Sangha to it. And to do that, you need to be able to participate in this free association of individuals. So you need to be in touch with that point of freedom. So really, this whole perspective of finding the point of freedom and the whole perspective of going for refuge effectively, they're very much talking about the same thing, really. Okay, so that's what I had to say. Hopefully it's food for thought. And what I'd like to do now is divide up into two groups, which we can use different ends of the shrine to do that. And so there's an opportunity to discuss that, to see if that fits your experience and explore it. Okay.
Thank you.